Today's private equity firms need the right insight to help them succeed in a rapidly evolving industry. With more than 100 years of experience, BDO helps private equity firms create value at every stage of the investment lifecycle. Visit BDO's website to learn more about our private equity practice and how we can support you in achieving your investment goals.
Hello, and welcome back to BDO's Private Equity Perspectives podcast, where we explore the trends impacting private equity today. I'm Todd Kinney, National Relationship Director in BDO's Private Equity Practice. Once again, we're lucky to be joined by Jason Frank, President and Chief Compliance Officer with BDO Capital Advisors, and Jamie Austin, Global Private Equity Leader and Partner at BDO UK. If you haven't already, I recommend listening to the first part of my conversation with Jason and Jamie, where we talked about some of the most pivotal factors currently facing private equity, as well as the continued pressure to make deals and why first-time investments might seem more attractive now than they did before. Today, our conversation will focus on buyer competition, value creation strategies, and driving growth despite a slow exits landscape. The second part of the episode will also touch on some of the findings revealed in BDO's annual private equity survey, which was recently released. If you find our conversation compelling, please head over to the PE page on BDO.com to download the full report where you can read all of the findings as well as our analysis. So just a quick reminder to our listeners that the remarks and opinions of our guests do not necessarily represent BDO's views. So Jason kicked us off last time on the first part of the episode. So today I want to turn to you first, Jamie. BDO's PE survey revealed that 43% of PE firms say most of the competition for deals will come from strategic buyers, while 24% actually cite sovereign wealth funds as their top competition. So Jamie, how's competition from other buyers, including strategic acquirers and the sovereign wealth funds, influencing deal strategies and valuations in today's market?
Yeah, it is a good question. And of course, there is not a shortage of capital, both with the sovereign wealth funds and in strategics. So stepping back a little bit, obviously, great businesses are always in great demand. And the pricing has remained high throughout what has been a tricky market over the last 2 or 3 years. The PE industry, as we see it today, has been around for 30, 40 years, and the strategics and the sovereign wealth funds have learned some of the tricks of the trade, making them very competitive. So there is stuff that needs to be done by the industry, but nothing stays the same forever. So we are going to see more innovation. Capital is restless. It's unsentimental stuff, and it will find a way. So, for instance, we are seeing deep sector strategies being used by private equity houses, focus on tech or tech-enabled businesses, and often they possess as much industry knowledge, if not more, than some strategics. And it would be the same with businesses in life sciences. And that's really impressive. Then, of course, what we're seeing is longer hold funds coming to the fore. And then why not partner with the sovereign wealth funds? Make them your friends, bring them in. And that is certainly what has been happening. The other thing we're seeing, and it's relatively recent, is that some of the very large funds are moving earlier in that growth journey. So two UK funds have very recently launched middle market strategies. We are seeing quite a lot of innovation coming in because private equity houses just can't wait around. They have to drive that change, which is obviously what it is that they do within the businesses that they buy. So they're going to move on once again from the strategics and move on once again from the sovereign wealth funds and make it more difficult for those competitors to win against them.
Right. Well, very interesting, Jamie. I appreciate your perspective. So, Jason, over to you. I'm wondering if you have a different opinion based on your role. How is competition from other buyers influencing deal strategies and valuations in today's market?
Well, from the investment banking perspective, we love the competition. It's great for our clients. It provides buyers at good multiples. In fact, a lot of times the competition drives higher multiples than are deserved by the financial and strategic metrics of our clients. We welcome that. This competition is simply because there is tons of liquidity in the marketplace. Private equity funds just in the US alone have $1 trillion of dry powder that they're looking to looking to commit to investments. Companies' balance sheets, they still have very healthy balance sheets that they're putting to work in addition to using equity as consideration for their transactions. The sovereign wealth, absolutely. There's tons of capital that is funneling into various industries that is adding new entrants and competitors in bidding. One differing type of competitor that is becoming more prevalent in the United States, at least, is family offices. Family offices have tons of liquidity. The sophisticated family offices have very good deal teams and experienced deal teams that know how to get deals done and are very creative with structures. The added benefit that family offices have over other financial buyers is they do not have a duration to their capital. They can make an acquisition and sit and hold for in perpetuity if necessary, and be very happy with operational gains and receiving dividends every year. So there is tons of competition out there, which, you know, our clients and us are very happy about. What we are telling our clients because of this competition, just don't be focused on the money. The money will, if you're a good asset that is attractive, people will come. The money will be there. The pricing will be there. What should be a very strong differentiation among all of these different potential acquirers that have the capital is their reputation. And are they truly the right partner for what our clients are looking to achieve? Money is money, but partners, you know, being the right partner for you is a significant differentiating factor that, from our opinion, a lot of these potential buyers can really stand out from one another by showing their true colors and really being a true partner to our clients.
All right, Jason, appreciate the insights. So I want to pivot and talk a bit about holding periods. According to our PE survey, 84% of PE firms say their fund's average holding period increased in the last year. I think pretty surprisingly, larger firms are seeing the biggest impact, with 29% of firms with $30 billion or more in assets under management saying their holding periods are 7 years or more. So many firms are experiencing extended holding periods for their investments. I think we all understand that. So the question for you guys, what value creation strategies are proving most effective when investments need to be held longer than initially planned? Jason, why don't you start us off on this one?
So I say this with all due respect to all of my private equity friends, colleagues, and relationships. They are in a tough boat these days. Private equity firms over the last, you know, 5 years, 6 years, ever really since COVID, which really was the high point, at least in the United States, of deal activity. There was a significant amount of transactions that were, I guess, overpriced, overlevered. And because of the geopolitical as well as economic and capital market type of issues that we're facing these days, be it from tariffs to Ukraine to Middle East, et cetera, you know, strategic and financial plans haven't necessarily turned out the way private equity funds and investors thought. So they are having a little bit of heartburn in terms of selling their portfolio companies, be it platforms or other add-ons that they had acquired for their platforms. And because they are holding these assets longer than their holding periods and their fund documents prescribed to their LPs, there is a significant liquidity crunch that is being experienced by these LPs that are demanding capital. They are looking for a return of capital. It's been longer than they've thought. So the LPs are pressuring the GPs. The GPs are faced with a very difficult decision. Do we continue to kind of grow and see if we can execute our value proposition with our portfolio companies before we sell? Or do we sell below what our targeted IRR was, take a loss, not a true loss, but a red flag that it's below their targeted IRRs and return of capital, just for the sake of returning money to their LPs? It is a tough, tough road that these private equity funds are facing these days. That in turn is affecting their new capital fundraising efforts. A lot of the LPs, because they haven't gotten returns yet, from their existing investments, are hesitant to reinvest in new capital for new funds, either existing asset managers or new asset managers. And it's creating a very, very difficult and turbulent marketplace for private equity funds. Again, from the investment banking perspective, there's still a tremendous amount of dry powder that these funds still need to deploy. So it's great for us and our clients, but the private equity funds and other investors are facing a very difficult time right now. How to use the money? When do we sell? How do we raise new capital to deploy? It's a very interesting marketplace that I do not envy my private equity friends.
Yeah, well, it's good to get the investment banker perspective for sure. So thanks, Jason. So Jamie, what are your thoughts? What value creation strategies are proving most effective when investments need to be held longer than initially planned?
Yeah, I think we've had a continued focus on the value add strategies, value creation over the last couple of years. And that's growing and actually is now being dialed into the playbooks of all really of the sophisticated funds. So the first one I talk about is add-ons. Add-ons it's not a nice to have anymore. You know, Jason was saying the buy, hold, sell strategy with a bit of leverage is gone. So add-ons are a perfect fillip for that. And we're seeing a crazy amount of add-on activity. In fact, we're seeing funds create their own almost internal investment banks and to try and find suitable add-ons for their platforms. And there is a crazy stat that on average now, a platform across the world will make 5 acquisitions during the tenure of a private equity house. You know, that's a massive, massive driver for the M&A market as a whole. So I would say add-ons is a really big piece. Other bits, and I think they come out of our survey, would be the cost optimization. I think funds are becoming more and more sophisticated at cost optimization. It's not just the preserve of the very large, the mega funds. It's seeping down all the way to the lower middle market where more sophisticated strategies are being deployed. Some of these are by in-house teams, but also coming to the likes of BDO and others for help in that area. I would also like to highlight risk management. I mean, risk is a fact of life, and risk is different to taking a leap of faith in the dark. So I feel that we're seeing also sophisticated owners of businesses looking at risk and truly understanding their risk so they can manage it. So it always needs pricing in. So there's a greater introspection around that, and then strategies coming to help manage risks. And the other piece I would like to highlight, which we might come and talk a little bit more about in a minute, is more sophisticated organic growth plays. So this is using operating partners with great track records elsewhere of delivering organic growth. And of course, the deployment of AI and machine learning to get ahead of the competition. All funds need to engage with this sort of activity. It is rife and it ain't going away. So there's a lot of things today, in spite of what's going on in the macroeconomics and geopolitical spheres. There's a lot of things that funds can and are doing to drive value into their platforms. And I wouldn't bet against them. Private equity is a phenomenally talented and it's got a very, very, of all asset classes, a very high return, risk-based return. So these will be successful.
As deal-making conditions evolve, private equity leaders need research-backed perspectives to guide their strategy. If you're enjoying this episode, please check out BDO's latest private equity survey to learn how tariff uncertainty is impacting deals and a whole lot more. Visit the BDO 2025 PE survey to understand how PE firms are adapting to the macro environment and how BDO can support your investment goals.
All right, Jamie, thanks for that. I'm going to stay on a somewhat similar topic with both of you. What approaches are you seeing the portfolio companies implement to drive organic growth in an environment where exits might be taking longer than originally anticipated? Jason, why don't you share your thoughts?
Just back to what Jamie was saying, at first I was disappointed to hear that he's saying a lot of private equity funds are creating their own internal investment banks. I want to address that's not good news for me. But in all seriousness, I agree with everything that Jamie was saying in terms of AI and cost savings and the way that portfolio companies are looking to grow from an organic standpoint. The biggest thing that we're seeing that our clients on the investment banking side are loving when they're talking with private equity funds is operating partners, where a lot of private equity funds are using more and more these days, not just the big ones, even smaller funds are getting a stable of operators with the experience that know the marketplace, that have grown businesses, sold businesses, and are in the position that these owners are in. That's a huge attraction. So not only is it a huge key to win the mandate and acquire the business, but to then be able to execute on the value proposition. You have someone who has been there, done that, knows the good things to do as well as the negative things, like the bad things. They not just because they're bad, but they've experienced it. And that's the best way to learn it. Like, you learn the best way by experience, good and bad. And these operating partners, because of who they are and what they've done in the industry already, know the proper way to move forward and extract value both internally as well as grow the top line using organic methods. It could be, everything from relooking at pricing to relooking at operating leverage, supply chain, implementing AI, everything that Jamie said. But really, the biggest differentiator that's becoming more and more common these days, from our perspective, is definitely operating partners.
All right, Jason. Appreciate that. So, Jamie, I guess I'd ask you, do you agree? What are some strategies you've seen portfolio companies implement to drive organic growth in an environment where exits are likely taking longer than planned?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with what Jason's saying. Yeah. You're getting the operating partners, and as Jason says, not just with the mega funds, but in the middle market and even down to lower middle market funds. And that is having a significantly positive impact. But beyond that, I'm seeing platform businesses start to look at their C-suite as well, and hiring positions like chief growth officer. I've seen the chief growth officer as a thing just take off in recent years, probably recent months. And I've got examples in the UK and in Germany where that is happening, and that is new. You start using AI and machine learning to get ahead of the competition, as I was saying earlier. And there is some fantastic plays around lead generation. And the lead generation is very sophisticated. Now, not only does it seek out where you might find new customers and clients, it will actually write your email, your first email, your second email, your third email for you, so that it's much easier to drive their lead generation. So it reduces the amount of administrative burden of looking for the new lead and leaves more time for actually converting them. And then we're seeing people using KOL networks. We're using AI centers of excellence and also technology partners. So, I mean, there's a whole heap of new tools that are now available to funds to present to their portcos so that they can look at differentially growing their top line and looking for that really valuable organic growth in what can be quite a choppy and difficult marketplace. So again, I think the the cold steel of capital is driving great innovation around these kind of themes. And we are, I suspect, going to see an asset class that will continue to outperform.
Yeah, well, lots of good insight packed in there from both of you on that topic. So I actually want to look further ahead now. You know, we've been talking about a rebound for some time. So as we look towards the future, what factors do you believe will ultimately determine when the M&A market will see a more substantial rebound? Jamie, why don't you kick us off here?
Well, I mean, one of the things that's been holding everything back has been high interest rates, which has meant that credit has been a lot more expensive. And that would in some way account for some of the findings of the survey where equity funding is prevalent. So we want inflation to stay under control, and we want to say interest rates, we want to stay low, and we want them to be stable. Right. And that will drive cheaper credit, which will be tremendous, Philip. Then, of course, geopolitical stability, I think it goes without saying. And the administration is very much looking to try and calm down the global world and get things much more on a business footing. And that will be super positive. Tariff stability, it came forth in the survey. It doesn't affect all businesses, but I think that the bark feels worse than the bite around that. But nevertheless, I think stability around tariffs and in the new world order will be very positive. Then I think there's still a bit of a bid-ask spread in the marketplace. So people harking back to the 21-22 marketplaces where the multiples were at a premium to the ones they are getting today. As time goes on, that will erode, in my opinion, and that will lead to more M&A. And ultimately, we're all humans.
And
investors, they get bored sitting on their hands, and the burn of dry powder will become so great that actually what we will see is people will get bored of it, and they will start to move, and we will see what was happening in Q1, as Jason pointed out earlier, it will continue. We will come back to a much more liquid market, which is good for all of us.
Sure is. Well, I appreciate that, Jamie. Again, it's nice to have your global perspective. We don't get that on every episode of the podcast. So again, appreciate that. Jason, anything else on your end you think might determine when the M&A market could see a bigger rebound?
Yeah, let's take that glass half full approach. You know, it's not all doom and gloom. It's, you know, for all of the reasons people thought coming into 2025 was positive, be it the open credit markets and, you know, inflation in check, employment doing well, for all of those factors that we talked about earlier. But in reality, the wild swings of the recent Q1 and Q2, it makes predictions kind of hard, probably harder than usual. What's clear is the world's changed, perceptions changed, not just in the US. You could point to all of the major economies and countries around the world. Things are changing, not just from financial markets, but, you know, geopolitical mark and cultural, you know, differences are definitely kind of rearing their heads right now. And it's making the deal market, as well as the private equity market, challenging in their own rights. But there is significant opportunity. There's plenty of capital, both equity as well as private debt, and the normal financial institutions of the world and all of the institutional banks, you know, they still have plenty of capital and healthy balance sheets. They're looking to get back into the marketplace and start doing deals again. The interesting thing about where we are today, all of the KPIs and all of the metrics are still very positive, which makes the glass half full. The glass half empty approach, we talked a little bit about distressed opportunities and private equity funds maybe selling portfolio companies earlier than they wanted to because the level of returns don't justify selling, and they're getting forced to sell. What we all need to remember, in not everyone remembers all the cycles that we've gone through over the last, you know, several decades. Unfortunately, I am old enough to remember those cycles. Someone's pain is someone else's benefit, meaning just because someone's selling at a loss means that good, disciplined investors have opportunities to find very good assets, be it companies, be it specific assets, real estate, inventory, intellectual property. You can find very attractive assets for even better attractive prices to add on to your current portfolio company or asset that can drive significant value into the future. So even if we do enter a down cycle, there will be definitely winners that are very disciplined, that have the capital, that stay within their lane and make investments that are smart for their existing investments that will benefit well into the future. So I'm very optimistic to what the market's going to be over the next 6, 12, 18, 24 months. in an upcycle or a downcycle, I still think there's tremendous opportunities for people.
All right, Jason, those are all good points, and I love the optimism. Unfortunately, we're reaching the end of the conversation with Jamie and Jason, but I do have one last question for both of you before we sign off. Obviously, the word we've been using a lot lately is uncertain. There's a lot we don't know about what could happen in the future, and private equity has to keep chugging along regardless. So Jason, starting with you, what advice would you give to PE firms navigating this period of uncertainty while still needing to deploy capital and generate returns?
So it's a great question. And unfortunately, many funds have to be dealing with this right now. And I fall back on what my experiences were in the last several down cycles where I saw it firsthand. If people stay true to their investment thesis in terms of size, in terms of industry, as all of the attributes that make up their investment focus, if they stay true to that and deploy capital in the appropriate way and don't overpay for assets or go for assets that they just don't understand or beyond their investment thesis, they're going to do great. If they go beyond what their expertise is in and what their focus is in, that's where we've seen a lot of funds as well as companies get in significant trouble. Overpaying for assets, not understanding how they truly operate, and not being able to extract the value that they thought was there. Not being able to, in terms of capital structure, over-leveraging businesses that don't necessarily align with the value creation plan that they have. And then not being able to refinance out and getting in trouble. That's where we saw a lot of companies and private equity funds get in trouble. And there's a phrase that it's definitely not my phrase. A lot of people use it, but to me, it's true in these types of uncertain markets. Some of the best deals you do are the deals that you don't do. And I think if, as long as funds and investors stay with that theme, they'll do great. When they go beyond it and overstretch and deploy capital because they think they have to, that's when they get in trouble.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Jason. Lots of good sound bites coming out of this episode. So Jamie, you're going to finish us up here. What advice would you give to PE firms during this period of uncertainty while still needing to deploy capital and generate returns?
Yeah. As Jason was saying earlier, a lot of those haven't had this sort of external capital before. And that's certainly what we've seen from your survey. And BDO has got the ability to skillfully help in all areas of the globe, anywhere where you'd want to go. And there's a lot of industry expertise there. And we've got great people and they care to do a great job. So beyond that, I get AIing. I would use the tools that are being developed and develop the tools yourself to identify those candidates, screen and investigate them, go early and seek that conviction early and stick, as Jason is saying, to your theses and move on those businesses that make sense. And lastly, in that chain, it's diligence hard, diligence early, and move quickly. My third thing, that's a bit of a theme, I guess, through all of today, has been innovate. Don't be afraid to innovate. Change up what you're doing. Stick to your lane, but change up how you go about it. Express yourself and innovate.
Great advertisement, Jamie. Appreciate it.
Yeah. I was going to say, Jason, he saved me having to do the BDO commercial. So
I mean it. I think we're the unsung heroes of this world. And we should, you know, those in the know BDO. I love it.
Talk to your advisors early. Get their perspective. Get their help. Because the sooner you engage your trusted advisors, the better off you're going to be.
Well said. Well said, Jason. Well, listeners, that concludes our episode for today. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and leave a review of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, this has been BDO's Private Equity Perspectives.
The views presented by our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of their respective firms.
Investment banking products and services within the United States are offered exclusively through BDO Capital Advisors LLC, a separate legal entity and affiliated company of BDO USA PC, a Virginia professional corporation. For more information, visit www.bdocap.com. Certain services may not be available to attest clients under the rules and regulations of public accounting. BDO Capital Advisors, LLC, member FINRA/SIPC.